grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its fucking house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. You know, as the magical world gets more and more online, we see more and more trends come through our community. These days, they aren't just relegated to online discourse, but they're showing up in real-world discussions at your local witchy shop, and some are even finding their way to your mainstream bookstore under the new releases section. You might remember the hold that Moldavite had over the online witchy world from the fall of 2020 until earlier this spring, 2021. That wasn't limited to TikTok, no matter how much some pagans like to pretend it was. It literally created a shortage in the supply of Moldavite, which has ripple effects throughout the mining and crystal industry still being felt today. Spiritual trends are part and parcel of our community growing, interacting with other parallel communities such as the wellness community, and attempting to syncretize ideas and practices into our existing witchy framework. As with all these things, there is a spectrum of harm here. For example, wearing a certain crystal, like an amethyst, as jewelry might be on the lower level of harm, while trends advocating for adding crystals to your food or drinking water might be on the higher end. Shadow work is a trend that seems to have come out of nowhere in the last 2 years. One cannot explore much of witchy social media these days without seeing recommendations to do your shadow work, which could mean anything from go to therapy to meditate more to write your feelings in a journal, depending on who's saying it and what the context is. As with many trends, plenty of people are trying to commodify it, with spiritual advisors of all sorts selling shadow work services alongside tarot and astrology readings, sometimes inserting that kind of shadow work into a reading without letting the querent, the person paying the money, know that it's about to happen. Spiritual dabblers are buying up shadow work journals and seeking out more information about how to do this work themselves or with a professional. But what is it exactly? And what makes a professional shadow worker? Shadow work is a term stemming from Jungian psychology and is a part of trauma therapy, a sensitive practice where licensed trauma counselors assist patients with processing serious traumatic events in their lives. It is delicate, difficult work that takes years of training to master. Because of the nature of this form of therapy, there are a number of risks involved with undertaking it, and even more risks when determining what kind of professional should assist you. And it's quite shocking whenever you go to have a tarot reading or a past life regression or an astrology reading, and suddenly the reader is talking to you about your undiagnosed trauma out of the blue, and you weren't aware that they were going to do that. I spoke to Lauren Teresa, a licensed trauma therapist and witch, to unpack how this term got wrapped up in modern spiritual discourse, what it really means, whether the online community's version of shadow work matches up with the reality of the work itself, and what warning signs to look out for when beginning shadow work. That's the interview on this episode of Inciting a Riot. A quick note before we dive in, because of the nature of the discussion itself, the fact that it centers around trauma therapy, trauma responses, and the like, I did feel that it was important to say that there should be a little bit of a trigger warning here at the beginning of the episode. It does discuss, not in graphic detail at all, but it does mention things like sexual assault. It mentions other types of things that are typical causes of trauma in people, both emotionally and physically. So you might be aware, if you are sensitive to trauma, generally speaking, this might be an episode to either have someone else listen to first or listen to at your leisure, or maybe skip over and go to another episode. So just wanted to put that up here at the beginning of the episode. Thanks so much and enjoy the interview. Lauren Teresa, welcome to Inciting a Riot. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here.
I am so excited to get to connect with you to talk about this really important subject today. I'm going to be really honest. I had never heard the term shadow work until about like 2 years ago, I want to say. Somewhere in the last 2 years, I heard it, and then suddenly I heard it everywhere. And I don't know if this is one of those situations where you buy a red Nissan and suddenly you see red Nissans everywhere, or if this is just coming out to the forefront. So I wanted to chat with you today because you are actually a real life witch who is also an actual trauma counselor. And so much of shadow work, as I understand it, is indeed rooted in trauma therapy. So for folks who have never seen you before, don't know much about your platform, why don't you tell folks a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Thank you. Yeah. So of course there's a lot there. And I'm sure I'm going to miss something, but I do identify as a witch, and it actually took me quite a long time to get there formally, despite the fact that I've been doing that work and my craft probably since childhood, but formally since I was a late teen. And it was always kind of running parallel to my formal education, quote unquote. Also very passionate about why things are the way they are and how they work and solving problems and whatnot. But I am a psychotherapist. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. My background in formal education is I have a bachelor's degree in art therapy, followed by I got my degree in social work and was practicing. I worked in a lot of different capacities individually, was always very passionate and drawn to working with trauma and individuals who have, really traverse those depths and, kind of helping and midwifing through that process. And I eventually in 2013 opened up my own center called Enodia, which was very tied in with Hecate and the symbolism of the goddess there. And there was a journey through what that was, but eventually, it was a place to work with and navigate trauma and major life transitions.
That's wonderful. And I love that you're drawn to that work. I love a dabbler. I've dabbled in that world as well. My formal education is in sociology. I worked in the court system for a very tiny bit of time working with children and families. And the work that you all do on the social work end, and especially in the actual counseling end, is pretty deep major stuff. But it's really interesting sort of diving into your own educational career and taking a look at what Enodia does. It's interesting because it directly ties into the roots of what we are calling shadow work. So for folks that have only seen the term shadow work in a caption on Instagram,
right?
What is shadow work? And I would love for you to sort of let me know what shadow work is, both from a spiritual perspective, as you understand it as a practitioner, but also what shadow work is from a trauma counselor perspective. And do those converge? Do they share a similarity? And what are the differences?
It's funny because it is absolutely everywhere right now. And I am also so happy to see it everywhere, even when it is kind of just in a hashtag at the end of somebody's post, because it's so needed right now. And I'll definitely, of course, go into that too. My framework and my understanding of shadow work stems from my training also as a Jungian therapist, Carl Jung, and the phrase that he had used and the context in which he utilized shadow work was a confrontation with the unconscious, a meeting of the parts of ourselves that are in the shadows, that are not there on the surface or in our conscious thought, but that are still very alive and that impact our day-to-day, how we react to somebody, how we, the choices we make, and it's an interesting thing because shadow work as a whole in the spiritual, soulful, and psychology community gets this kind of this dark veil over it as it's something, you're just meeting the negative or the trauma, but it also is all the parts of ourselves that we don't want to see because it might freak us out, because it might be who we actually are, who we're actually, you know, maybe afraid to admit because that means we're going to need to uproot our lives or change everything, which I could definitely speak to. But, you know, to answer your question too about the convergence, there is. It's both. And I don't think there's a clear delineation, you know, without going too much into all of it, you know, Carl Jung himself and like the going back into the origins of depth psychology, which is my training, it was not separate from the spiritual. And, you know, when you confront the unconscious, there's images, there's demons, there's voices, there's all of these things. And it doesn't matter whether you think of them as something outside of yourself or within your psyche, it's all kind of the same, if that makes sense. And there's really a lot to kind of parse out there. So I definitely am happy we're having this conversation. And
so I'm curious, because when you tell me that it's the parts of ourselves that are not in conscious thought, mm-hmm. my brain immediately brings up the term implicit bias. The ways in which we interact with the world and the ways in which we interact with each other based on decisions that we're making that we don't even realize that we're making. When you see a person that looks a certain way, you cross the street. You don't, at some point in your life, you're not conscious of why you're doing it. You just do it. You know, some of these implicit biases are there to protect us. We evolved the skill as a way of self-preservation, and some of them are there because we're flawed creatures, and things like homophobia, transphobia, racism, classism, etc., get deeply rooted into our psyches from a very young age, and it's difficult to then recognize it, uproot it, and parse out, you know, why we're doing these things and how to undo them. So can you walk me through, is our shadow self part of this implicit bias? Are these two sides of the same coin? Where are those things?
Absolutely. And I completely agree with you on that. And that's part of why, you know, it's kind of a radical statement to make, but I'm of the mindset that if we all actually did shadow work and received, you know, and also got support, you know, when appropriate and when needed, which I know we'll go into on the trauma end. If we all did that shadow work, I mean, I think that's the healing balm, for lack of a better term, that we need culturally, collectively, individually.
So it sounds like shadow work then is the process of uncovering all of those implicit biases, but also maybe, you know, the thoughts about ourselves that we don't like to think about. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of all that is there, that is part of us, you know, kind of lurking underneath the surface and in our murky waters. And it's mostly what we're not fully aware of, you know.
So can I ask what trauma is? And when you hear the word trauma, I immediately think of, you know, an episode of Grey's Anatomy. It's really easy to see something like physical trauma, right?
Yeah,
when you've been injured in a terrible accident, you know, I think of that scene in Grey's Anatomy where the guy comes in and he's like encased in concrete, or that comes in and like a tree got shoved through his body. Those early seasons of Grey's Anatomy. Can you tell that I've been that during the quarantine? But, it's easy to think of physical trauma, but I don't know that that's necessarily the work that you do. So what is it? What is the work that you do? What is trauma therapy?
So within my work and within my own personal work and also with clients and in the trauma world at large, you know, within mental health, trauma is, it's a bit of a misconception about it, because although there are significant events that on paper are extremely harmful and hurtful and disruptive and damaging, it's more than just the event. So the trauma, when we talk about trauma, it's not so much the what, it's not what happened so much as it is what happens after. Mm. It's the processing. It's the way that meaning or lack of meaning kind of unfolds after an experience. So I can use a concrete example. You know, we're talking about physical trauma. And for example, if you get into a car crash, it can shake up every aspect of your system. One person who got into the same car crash might go home and, they might walk into a very responsive environment where people are asking how they're doing and how they're feeling and if they're okay. They might have been able to get some support right after physically. You know, another person might walk into an environment where they immediately don't have the space to talk about it or to really go with it or to figure out, you know, what that even was about. That tends to be when things get stuck. So when we talk about trauma and emotional psychological trauma, a lot of the time we're talking about things that got stuck because they didn't get to be fully processed, understood, and we didn't get the ability to fit that into our worldview. So basically we didn't get to process it and it gets stuck. And it will often keep coming up and coming up and coming up until we're able to dive into it and to make meaning from it in a way. And to understand it in a way that can sit well within our bodies and our psyches.
It sounds like there's a lot of privilege wrapped up in the ability to process trauma.
There is. I mean, I feel like that in and of itself is a whole conversation. And, you know, when we talk about trauma work, you know, it's easy to say, like, you should go and get support, talk to a counselor who is fully trained and licensed and credentialed, and then be able to get EMDR therapy if necessary, and then be able to see somebody, you know, X, Y, and Z times a week. But that's not an accessible option for most people.
It's easy for me to process terrible things that happen if, you know, go back to that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If my base needs are being met, if I have food in my fridge, if I have time, just actual time in my day, you know, if my home is clean, if my laundry is done, if I have access to clean water, if I have enough money to, you know, do something that makes me happy. It's easier for me to process terrible things if some of those base needs and maybe even, you know, that higher up, you know, I have the ability to pay for joy in my life and I have a supportive environment. Now, I think though that I can't bring up the concept of privilege in a conversation like this without mentioning that the ability to see a therapist is also quite a privileged thing. I mean, at least here in the United States.
You know, and it was interesting as my kind of journey with Enodia went on and I was personally called through my own work to actually close up or to kind of bring things back underground for a time being, going back into that kind of void. That was one of the biggest pieces that was coming up was, you know, it's like, how can you hold two truths? You're working and helping and, you know, facilitating this healing, but then also you're within a system that is so damaged, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. Flawed doesn't even begin to sum it up. But that was one of the areas that I have been having and always have had a really hard time with. And part of kind of closing things up and going back into that space was trying to figure out how to shift that around so that way we're actually walking the walk and not just serving and supporting the individuals who were of a specific, you know, ability to pay or to have that time or to have, you know, those options. I mean, talking about from individual outpatient therapy and then also, you know, when individuals need more support, you know, more intensive support, inpatient support, or, you know, 24-hour. And the disparity between where you will go and what you will experience if you can pay out of pocket versus what you will experience and where you will go when you cannot it's sickening. And it has been. And I have a lot to say about that.
Feel free. We have no time limit. But I something that you just said struck me. You know, you said there might be a need for round the clock care. There might need to be.
Yeah.
Inpatient therapy. There's different levels of this. So when people are talking about shadow work, when people are talking about trauma counseling, it sounds like there's some pretty high stakes here.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a piece that, you know, when talking about the container that the level of responsibility that the practitioner does need to take on, that is extremely important to acknowledge. And honestly, that's one of my biggest issues when seeing individuals who are kind of offering services or making promises, usually more on like a spiritual front, as far as healing trauma and traversing these depths, is that it gets extremely deep. And there needs to be structure and systems in place to support the person walking that. And sometimes, absolutely, within this work, you're bringing a torch down into the deepest, darkest recesses of the underworld. You know, you need to know where you're going to be able to stop and take a break, you know, where you might need to rest and where you might need to call in other supports. And I am very critical of psychology and the field and all of that, and have raised and picked a lot of fights, and I will continue to always. But that is one area where I feel, you know, psychology and mental health, there is a kind of governing body. There is a structure in place to support the individual who's walking that, and also the people who are helping them walk that. And that's important. That's necessary.
I think that that's a good point to bring up, is the fact that, one, you've had formal training, a lot of it. Can I ask about, you know, just what does it take to become a trauma counselor? Just actually, you know, to become a legit licensed, actual, you know, with multiple degrees trauma counselor? Like, how many years of this have you put in, field work, that kind of thing?
There needs to be a graduate degree, and then postgraduate hours. There's different routes you could take. You know, you can become a licensed professional counselor or a licensed clinical social worker. And if anybody listening has any questions about specifics, you know, I'm always happy to respond to things like that. I did 4 years undergraduate in art therapy, and then 2 years in an intensive program for social work. And during those 2 years and after, I had to put in, I think it was 2,000 hours of direct practice, of direct clinical work. More recently, I think after maybe like a 5-year hiatus, I went back and was pursuing my doctorate to kind of go back to the foundation of psychology. And that wasn't a clinical program, so that wasn't required, but a graduate degree was required, 2,000 hours. And all along the way, you have people who are holding you accountable, which is a big deal. It's a big thing. In the training, you know, you're learning the ins and outs. You're learning, I think one of the first books was what to ask and what to say, or something like that. You know, you're learning the basics. But there's constantly supervisors, and there's constantly people asking you, oh, what are you feeling? How are you? What's happening for you? What do you think's happening for you? Let me tell you what I think's happening for you. And you're, as a practitioner, as a therapist, or, you know, as a practitioner, you're constantly getting the mirror shown up to you and asking yourself and having others ask you, what's happening for you? What's happening for you while you help this person go through this? That piece is honestly, I feel like that piece is probably one of the most significant in the development of becoming a counselor. So whichever route you take, there's under the umbrella of psychology, there is the supervision piece. And there's often needing to be in your own counseling, though not every program requires that. You know, they should. But again, that is a, you know, privileged place to be in too, to be able to afford that. But yeah, there's always that mirror there, and it's exhausting, but it forces you into your own stuff, you know, and you need to walk that and traverse all of that constantly in order to be able to be really present with somebody and also make sure that you're holding a container for them to do the work that they need to do.
2,000 hours of direct clinical work is a lot.
A lot.
That's a lot. And I imagine that when you're doing this direct clinical work, you're not just given some patients that are going through some, you know, I tried to unalive myself last week. Here, have this student. She would very much like to talk to you about the trauma surrounding that or something like that. You know, what does that structure look like?
You mean as far as when and how and where?
Yeah, like in? So you're in these 2,000 hours phase. I mean, obviously, I think we all kind of know what it looks like to get a degree. You know,
you
go into insane amounts of debt. You know, there's plenty of elitist, patriarchal, institutionalized criticisms that we can levy at higher learning and the gatekeeping of getting a degree.
Yeah.
But it's this 2,000 hours that I think is really where the training of being somebody who interacts with people in these very sensitive areas starts to set yourself apart. Yes, you have formal training. You know what all the words mean and you passed all your tests. Right. But then you actually go and you do the stuff, and you do the stuff with people that are sitting there telling you, you know, where the boundaries are. What does that period of time look like?
And that was that period of time. It's interesting. Of course, it's not called shadow work, but for the therapist, it really was, you know, and it was interesting that the 2000 hours were actually post, like we had to do internships before. And then once we had our, if I'm not mistaken, it's been a while, but once we had our formal degree and licensure, then there was 2000 hours to become a clinical person, which means that I can, you know, sit down face to face with somebody, just the two of us, and really, you know, support them, you know, as an intern or as a therapist. We had to do these process recordings where, after sitting with a person, after sitting with an individual, we would have to write out the best we could, the dialogue, like, which in and of itself, especially as somebody who's neurodivergent, and like, it was a lot to do to have all of that reflective, awareness on that 1 hour that I sat with the person. But we had to write out the dialogue, and then we had to write the, what we thought they were thinking, what we thought was happening, what we thought maybe that was going on for them on an inner level. And then the next column, we had to write what we were thinking, or we thought we were thinking at each moment. And then there was a fourth column where our supervisor, who would be somebody, basically it was like kind of like a therapist for the therapist at the time.
Are they in the room with you? Listening back? Are they watching taped sessions or anything like that?
Not in my training.
Okay.
Not in the framework. There are some paths that do that. Kind of always bug me out a little bit.
It's performance anxiety being watched.
Ooh, my film is weird.
But they are seeing these comprehensive dialogue notes.
Comprehensive dialogue notes. Yeah. And then they're also giving us feedback as to, you know, why do you think that you responded like this? What was happening for you? So it was mind numbing at times, but again, going back to that constant kind of reflection was heavy, you know. And it was interesting because when I was a LCSW, so when I was already kind of doing the individual work, you know, I went back for my training in EMDR. That's also a word that kind of comes up. And
could we define that for people that don't know what it is?
So it's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is a whole lot of words. It is one of the many types of therapies that help you get out of your own way and get into what's actually happening in yourself. Mm. You can get there in dreams. You can get there in poetry and free association writing. You can get there in trance work. You can get there. There's a lot of ways you can get there. EMDR is just one of them. But when I was in my training for that, we also had to, and we had to experience it. So while we were learning, we had to also be on the receiving end of it. And that took me to some, I thought it was so funny when you think you're done, or you think you're like at least good. You know, I'd been in the field like over 10 years at that point, and it took me to depths that I wasn't even conscious of in any way. So there is that. There's that constant, like, you know, reflection back and accountability. And that, as a practitioner, I feel like are two really, really important pillars to stand on when trying to responsibly help people navigate their inner worlds.
So it sounds to me that trauma and the work around trauma counseling is dealing with some pretty big stakes stuff. It's not just, I'm dealing with depression, I'm dealing with anxiety, I'm dealing with this kind of thing. It's there's major, major trauma that I have not been able to process and work through. Either there's a specific life event, or there's a specific period in my life that so deeply impacted me that I am unable to move forward from that. Is there a difference between traditional counseling towards like depression, anxiety? I mean, I deal with anxiety. My husband deals with depression. We've both been through therapy for that, and that's a forever thing. Is there a difference between traditional therapy methods and what I might go through to deal with trauma?
I mean, my initial response is no.
Okay.
That's good
to know. I mean, trauma is a scary word for people. It might be nice to know that it's just...
I I know. You know, it's funny. I'm talking about this and I'm, you know, and it's heavy and it's intense at the same time. Literally everyone, all of us have this, mm-hmm. and there's not a clear delineation. There's not somebody who has trauma that needs to see a trauma therapist and somebody who is good. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't work like that. I do want to go into that too, especially as we start talking about the convergence or, you know, where it weaves into the spiritual stuff, because yes, sometimes people come into therapy with that, you know, where it's like, I am stuck. I know what I experienced. I know what's there. I need to process it. I need to, you know, not have flashbacks or, you know, not have these crippling panic attacks every time I have this specific trigger. You know, like sometimes it does happen like that. But sometimes, you know, you're just kind of getting a sense like, I kind of want to see what's there, you know, or you know that there's stuff, but you might not know what it is. So, you know, when going into any kind of work that peels back layers, any kind of work that drops the veil or that has you really meet your unconscious, there has to be a safe container and there has to be a level of responsibility and, I don't want to use the word training, but there has to be a level of responsibility and accountability and a foundation that the practitioner has when guiding people through it. I mean, I've encountered some really heavy stuff in, you know, in moon circles.
Sure.
I think.
Sure.
You know,
Walk this weird spiritual witchy path enough time for long enough and you will meet some dark faces in some dark places.
Yeah. And it's not separate. None of it's separate, mm-hmm. you know, and that's why it's so important to be having this conversation, because you can't really look at it and be like, oh, no, there's no trauma. I'm good. So I'm just going to, you know, move on with my life. I mean, maybe because I've been immersed in it on all the levels for the better part of my adult life. But I think that like almost everything comes down to trauma mm-hmm. individually and collectively. You know, I don't want to reduce obviously things, but it comes down to trauma, and we need to be able to work with trauma in an appropriate way. You know, we can't band-aid it. We can't tell people it doesn't exist. We can't give them, you know, a one-stop session and then tell them they're good in psychology or in any kind of spiritual work. You know, it has to be walked through with care and caution on all fronts.
So I want to directly ask then, speaking of care and caution, about why do we need so much care and caution? What are the stakes of trauma counseling, of unresolved trauma? What are the stakes here? What are we actually talking about? Obviously, I'm sure there's a spectrum.
It's so nuanced of a topic. The idea of trauma and initiation, because we try to put everything into these little boxes and into like 48 characters or less and understand it. But this is a big one, the idea of trauma and meeting our inner selves and going through our own underworld journey and seeing what's there and working through it and walking through it. Being also a vital part of our stepping into the deeper work. I definitely would love to talk about that and to have a dialogue about that. That comes up sometimes and it's misconstrued, because trauma, when you say like with trauma and initiation, you know what I'm saying? What I'm talking about, I'm saying initiation kind of in the spiritual realm, like in the...
Are you talking about entering into like, you know, the easiest one that comes to mind is like Wicca, like an initiatory tradition? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, totally. Or like in any of the mystery schools,
yeah, sure.
Or, you know, definitely like any of that deeper work, there is a... kind of an underworld journey. There's a hell. There's a threshold that one crosses and goes through. It is extremely high stakes. And the bigger it is, the more epic the journey is, you know, the more risky that journey is. You know, we can look at it even in the way that we express ourselves in pop culture, you know, and in movies and stuff. Like the most epic journeys are always this close to death. And that's not, you know, separate from us. I mean, what we see in images on the screen, usually that's a projection of what's happening collectively sometimes. usually it is. So, you know, there's high stakes in the way that it's so important to do, because it's part of our collective and our individual becoming, you know, finding who we are, opening up to our magic, opening up to, you know, all of that. And then there's also the piece that you're actually talking about, you know, death and rebirth. And it's, yeah, it's symbolic sometimes, but it's also, you know, you're walking that edge, you're walking that line.
So I'm interested in this topic twofold. One, because social media has led me to believe that, like the term self-care, shadow work is a lot of me sitting quietly with my thoughts, writing in a journal, and crying into that journal. It's a lot of journals. If you look up on Amazon, if you look up like books about shadow work, it's a lot of journals. Yeah. It's just a lot of writing your feelings out and talking to yourself. And is that shadow work? Can I go to Amazon and get a journal and do shadow work on my own successfully? Walk me through that.
Yeah. So it's not. And I gotta tell you, I have a lot of journals. It's not because you're also meeting yourself.
Sure.
You know, and also, you know, the human experience, our psyche, our bodies are incredible. You know, we are extremely resilient and we're able to know where, for the most part, we're able to know where our limits and parameters are. So if you're sitting alone in your room, I'm gonna put this on you, while you're sitting in your room with your book, you know, there's also protective responses there and there's defenses. So more often than not, you know, we'll really only go as far as is safe to go.
Mm.
With some exception, of course, but that's typically the way it is. And a lot of times that's the case in therapy, especially talk therapy. You know, there's defenses that are in place and they're there for a reason. And, you know, defenses get a bad rap, but we got to honor them because they keep us intact and protected. When you start talking about shadow work, especially when it gets facilitated by other practitioners, or when you're guided into deeper places, whether that again be in the spiritual work and communities or in therapy, the work is starting to peel back the defenses. And that's where it gets intense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it gets real. And when you're getting real, you're also walking that line of life and death. You're also getting into some things that are really heavy and really intense. So, you know, when we're sitting by ourselves,
is it fair to say that if I peel back enough of those layers and I get to perhaps a dark enough place that there might be some risk to myself, physically or mentally or spiritually or all of the above, if I'm not truly in a place that I can support that trauma work? I mean, we talked at the beginning of our conversation about how privileged kind of one has to be able to process trauma. If I know that I have trauma or I suspect that I have trauma and I go and I get a journal or I go and I do, you know, exercises that I see on YouTube or something like that, and I start bringing up serious stuff, but I'm not in a place to handle that on my own, or maybe I would have already done my own, maybe I would have already worked through my own trauma if I were, you know, in a place to process trauma. What's that risk? I mean, that space seems like it has some risk there to it.
It does. And I think anything that's really important and valuable and magical in life isn't without risk.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, when we're doing it independently, you know, I think that's a different thing. And I don't want to dissuade anybody from doing that work. I mean, some of the most intense excavations that I've done have been in my own shadow work and actually my own journals. You know, that is very real, very valid work. You know, I can speak to this when, you know, I don't want to derail it, but in some of my own journaling and in my shadow work, I also set boundaries.
Mm.
And I've actually wrote out contracts as I was getting into these depths. Cause I, you know, at 30, at the time of in my mid 30s, I started remembering things that I actually hadn't known consciously about certain traumas and experiences and aspects of myself. So I was able to set those boundaries. But there's still, like, when you're doing your own work, those defenses are there. When you start to work with another person, it changes the dynamic. And that's where it's the responsibility of the practitioner to be able to hold a safe container. Because if, you know, you're sitting, me as a practitioner, I'm sitting with somebody and readying them to peel back all of their layers of defenses, that is a heavy responsibility. And I need to be able to walk that with open eyes, torches lit, know, you know, what's mine, what's not, and, you know, what to do when.
You mentioned that there are things that you did in your own shadow work that brought up memories that you hadn't either thought of consciously or possibly had even repressed. I don't know. But there is a lot of controversy around that. I almost want to call it an industry, but around the concept of both repressed and recovered memories, because so much of the conversation around repressed and recovered memories does tend to coincide with trauma, but also, you know, harkens back to things like the satanic panic. You know, recovered memory is linked to, you know, false memory, planted memory, things like that. So if I'm on my own and I'm doing this work, and I don't have a lot of experience in therapy because I don't have enough privileges to have seen a therapist over the years, dealing with things that I believe I'm suddenly remembering, how do I know that I'm actually, one, experiencing a real memory? Two, how do I process that? And three, how do I know that it's not something that I've, that has been planted in there? And, you know, what do I do to go about working through that kind of thing?
It's an interesting thing when we talk about, like, memory, and we start talking about, like, the idea of false memory. Mm-hmm. And that's actually, as somebody in that's been pretty deep in the world of trauma therapy and the psychology world, we've moved away from that a little bit. A lot of the times, again, generally, like, nothing is going to be 100%, of course. But a lot of the times when we start talking about things that are there or that pop up in our consciousness that are not actually from our experience, those are things that have actually been placed by others, usually the other person who is helping them do the work. Does that make sense?
Walk me through that. So,
yeah.
So like, if I'm your patient and I'm remembering something, you've put it there?
The first example comes to mind, you know, when somebody guides somebody through a past life regression, or when somebody guides somebody through their own inner caverns, or, like, a lot of the time, if something comes up that's not authentically from that person, either, I want to walk this carefully, because there's a lot of nuance there. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot that over the years has gotten has become very damaging. Mm-hmm. Like you were just talking about with the satanic panic. Absolutely. Also, you know, when it comes to memory and recovered memory and trauma, the way we process memory when we've gone through a traumatic experience is very different than we process memory in our just typical waking life. So when people start having, you know, an inkling that they've experienced trauma or start having memories, it is fragmented. It sometimes comes out in symbols. It sometimes comes out literally. It can be hyperfixation on one thing, like just seeing a red shirt, you know. The timelines could be fuzzy. So that piece...
Is that... I'm so sorry to interrupt, and I want you to continue, but is that what people call triggers? Like, where you see a red shirt and that brings up a memory? Or is that, you know, I eat spaghetti and...
Yeah. Yeah, no, it can be. It totally can be. And it's important to acknowledge that the non-linear stuff that comes up for us is valid. And it does not mean that it's false or implanted or anything like that. I, as a therapist, as a trauma therapist, I don't want to say I denounce that idea of false memory, but it has been used to minimize the experience or completely void the experience of trauma survivors because their account of what they've experienced is not linear, might sound like it's some parts of it are magical or made up, you know, so it's dicey. I haven't seen in all the years I've been working it, I've never seen a situation where somebody had a false memory that was...
I went into the secret basement of the cult and there was Satan there and he was eating babies and that, yeah, that when no, I, when, because, you know, I'm gonna be real honest. When I think of false memory, recovered memory, I think of that. I think of the Pizzagate stuff. I think of, you know, that, that extreme.
And if you think about it though, when that stuff happens, it's influenced by something else though. Mm-hmm. It's always influenced by something else. It's influenced by, you know, I mean, referencing like conspiracies, it's influenced by that kind of being the type of trauma therapy that I feel is very meaningful and important. Also deals with things on a non-concrete, non-linear level. So this is kind of where there's the overlap of all of this. I work with the image. I work with the imaginal. I work with the, you know, somebody comes in and they say, I see this green frog picking up a knife. This has never happened, but I see a green frog picking up a knife and threatening me. That's what I see. Okay. you know, of course I'm not going to come out and say, this is made up, you know, this X, Y, and Z is not valid. You know, we step into, okay, what's there? What feelings are there? What does this mean for you? And we go deeper into it. I follow that person's lead and let them go down that rabbit hole, gets a bad rap too, but go down that hole into what meaning does that hold? If somebody's experiencing something and it's creating a trauma response, it's creating a discord, it's creating triggers, it's harming their ability to be in their body or in their world, there's reason and there's a meaning and there's trauma to it. And that's valid. You know, sometimes it's not literal. Sometimes it is. And that's also something that as a practitioner, I help them kind of get to what is your gut saying about this? Does this feel this is a literal experience? Does this feel like there might be a deeper meaning to that? Hmm. Where do you feel this needs to go? Because you know what? There could have been a frog. Those things, you know, who am I to say this something is valid and real and something's not? So I've always erred on the side of everything you bring in, we're validating it and we're going with it and we're exploring it. And it means something. It all means something. When you're in the world of navigating that from the framework of mental health, the therapist is somewhat of a blank slate still. So that way the person can really go there and bounce ideas and figure it out. When you go there in some other contexts, like in some spiritual communities I've been in, there's a lot of leading questions. There's a lot of labeling or saying, oh, this is symbolic of this. Or not always. But that element is there. And that's where things can get confusing and dicey. And, you know, you can come up with a false storyline that wasn't maybe completely the whole story.
So yeah. We're here. You know, I said that one of the reasons why I was so curious to talk to you about shadow work is because of sort of the commodification of it, the social media self-helpification of it all. The other aspect, of course, is that, you know, you brought up past life regression. You brought up that there is a pretty big overlap in trauma counseling therapy in general with spiritual services. And I want to speak directly to the fact that somebody could go in for past life regression, a tarot card reading, a psychic reading, a mediumship reading or whatever. And suddenly there's trauma therapy happening right in the middle of it. And you don't realize it. I've heard, you know, of people going in for past life readings and suddenly being told that they were sexually assaulted. Suddenly being told that they were the victim of this kind of abuse or of that terrible thing or something like that. And when you say it in the context of a conversation like this, I'm sure a listener at home would go, well, gosh, that's of course, obviously terrible. Why would you ever tell someone that? But to be fair, there are a lot of people, especially if my social media comments are any indication, there are a lot of people out there who think that it is fine and good and valid for anyone hanging their tile out to provide psychic or spiritual services of any kind to engage in that kind of dialogue and conversation. And I'd like you to speak for a moment as somebody who is in both worlds, professionally and spiritually, to sort of what is somebody getting out of that psychic interaction there? What is the potential for harm there? What is the difference between somebody coming to you and someone going to Psychic Sue, to borrow from Will and Grace?
The seriousness and the awareness and the acknowledgement of the depths to which that can and may and will go is big, you know, and I don't, especially, you know, as a self-identified witch, you know, and as somebody who has been involved and still to this day, I mean, I did my cards before we talked, you know, I'm very much immersed, you know, it is my life as well. I don't want to completely, I'm not going to invalidate those, those things because as you know, I mean, of course, you know, those are of course very real. There also tends to be a, and I could speak to my own past with this pre, you know, trauma center opening, you know, there also tends to be a barrier to understanding and allowing and acknowledging the heavy, the dark, the seriousness, the depths of the work. You know, we see that a lot, you know, with, you know, with the good vibes only and, you know, the spiritual space, it's, you know, it's all light. It's all that. And when in reality, it's not. And you can't just say nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to come into this space as a practitioner. You can't say nothing negative will happen. I'm going to cleanse this space. I'm going to make sure, you know, this is only, you know, the guides that are going to be helpful are here, X, Y, and Z. Because you're also working with another person who's coming in with their own stuff. So along the path that I walked within my formal training, there was that piece of constantly, you know, this can get really intense. And if and when it does, let's know what to do when. How to actually support the person through those parts of it. You know, when somebody comes into my office or when somebody would come into my office and we'd start working, more often than not, as part of the beginning piece, we talk about self-harm. We talk about, you know, that this can be a matter of life or death at times, and not to fear that and not to shy away from it or not acknowledge it. But, you know, we bring all of that right to the surface, right in the front. And in a way of like, let's talk about it. More often than not, thoughts, especially, you know, suicidal thoughts or thoughts of literally any kind, can and will come up. And it's important that they're allowed, and it's important that they're, you know, not pushed further into the shadows. Also, as part of that work, you know, when we start out, I ask the person, you know, if you do need a higher level of support, what would that look like? Who would you call? If you need even more support, professional support, where would you go? Where would you want to go? Like, I encourage people that have insurance, call your insurance company and find out if inpatient hospitalizations are covered. And if they are, where and what do you, where would you want to go? You know, and I worked with people who were on all different ends of, you know, how intense they thought their experiences were, but it was important information to have up front for them. And nobody at the end of the day was put off by it. It was like, okay, we're actually being real. You know, we're unlocking doors. We're opening boxes. We're peeling back all the layers of, I mean, it's very dramatic. It's not always like this in the very beginning, but you know, we're peeling back all the layers of defenses. Like let's have a container. Let's know what our safety net looks like and actually do it. And when you walk into somebody's space, who's not fully doing that, it can get dicey. I encourage my clients, you know, my clients, you know, in the last house, it was like the Enodia house, there was symbolism and imagery everywhere. There, my crystals were all over the place. Like it was a very, it was an awesome spot. but you know, I had clients that were doing both, that were also seeing, you know, we're either getting Reiki or we're getting spiritual support. And I think that both are extremely important, but yeah, you need that container and you need that ability to say, okay, what are we going to do when things get really intense, because they do. We're humans. They're going to.
It sounds like, and please stop me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds like the problems, the potential problems, lie in the areas of things like ethic of care. You know, you have enough training, you have enough clinical hours to know the full scope of potential harm. If I bring certain things up, it could lead to self-harm. If I bring certain, you know, if there are certain things that come up for this person and they do not have the proper structure to deal with it, you know, it could lead to further, you know, depression, anxiety, inability to cope with this, you know, further harm, that kind of thing. The other piece of that is the accountability piece. You know, because you are licensed, you can have that license taken away. You know, there is basic information you have to know to go through this. There's basic, I'm sure, continuing education courses, relicensing, that kind of thing that you have to go through in order to continue to be able to practice. Whereas if I hang my tile out there and I say that I offer things that sometimes lead to trauma therapy, to are disguised as, I'm going to use para pseudo trauma therapy, you know, words like shadow work is one that isn't, it's sort of like saying, you know, this bread is made with natural ingredients versus this bread is organic. Organic is a word that means something. You can't put the word organic on a food product unless it meets a certain standard, but you can put the word natural on something and it means nothing.
Nothing.
It means absolutely nothing. That bread could have been squirted out of a tube made out of who knows what, and they can call it natural, but they cannot call it organic unless it means a certain standard. So from my understanding and being in the community, seeing how this is playing out in the last few years on social media and the community at large, and from conversations with you and other people in the mental health field, it sounds like some of these terms are more using the word natural and trying to get away with it. Past life regression work, you know, shadow work is another one that's real big, because it is, there's a legitimate use for that term versus somebody saying that they are a trauma counselor. Right. I can't just say I'm a trauma counselor.
Quite a few people knocking on your door being like,
you can't just say that, but you can say that you offer past life regression and it's a sneaky backdoor way of saying that you're going to talk about, oh, you know what? You were raped 300 years ago. Let's talk about that.
Right. And the accountability piece, I mean, that's huge, you know, and I'm generally like governing bodies. I take quite a bit of issues with many governing bodies.
I don't think that there's any piece of this conversation in which we've said, because you have a license, because you went to school, and because you did all of these things, you are now exempt from possibly harming people. I mean, there's part of that in which you have played into multiple elitist institutions to get your licenses and credentials.
100%. I mean, It's so gross, and I know it is, and I have such issues with academia in general too. I mean, that's a whole other thing, but it's not, you know, but the piece about accountability there, and that there is this kind of bigger, you know, it is a governing body that holds you accountable and that constantly makes you check in with yourself, is key and it's huge. You know, it would be amazing if there's, you know, a whole team of shadow workers and witches and everybody kind of getting together and forming a governing body where we can hold each other accountable and do certain readings and do all this deeper work. And there may definitely be individuals doing that, for sure. Don't think academia is the only path at all. It's so new. I mean, we're talking like psychology only came about in the like 1800s and we're like, this is... how humans work. Oh, come on. But there's the oversight and there's the accountability, you know, and that constant mirror. And that's huge. Yeah. But with shadow work, like you got to acknowledge that it's going to get really heavy and really dark and that you're walking the fine line between death and life. You know, it's almost like, it kind of comes up right now for me, but like my experience with childbirth, where, you know, there was that moment, everybody's telling you, this is great. It's so magical. This is, you know, this is, oh, you're a goddess, blah, blah, blah. But there was like a really heavy moment too, at least, you know, my, and especially with my second daughter, where I was like, oh shit, like I'm walking that line of life and death. And this is, yeah, it's, of course it's beautiful and intense and meaningful. And also it's heavy and violent. And, you know, you need to acknowledge that. If I, and I mean, my, you know, just as an aside, my childbirth experience was I needed the support of medical professionals in a hospital to be mm-hmm. able to facilitate this beautiful experience, but that needed to be there. If I just said, nah, I got this, I'll do this on my own, and had somebody telling me it was fine, it would have had a very different outcome. So I digress, but I think it's pretty, you know.
No, but I'm glad that you bring that up, because when we talk about it, I mean, there is there's a medical aspect to this. Your mental health is health. Your mental health is medicine. And, you know, if I go get in a physically traumatic accident and I've got a bone sticking out of my body, it's very clear. Not a lot of people are going to be upset. You know, not a lot of people are going to be like, no, no, come over here. I'm going to do crystals about it.
Right.
But for some reason, when it's harm and trauma that we can't see, suddenly the lines of the treatment for that get blurred. Oh, I can do crystals about that. I love doing crystals about stuff. Listen, if I can do crystals about it, if I can do witching about it, that's great. But I also know when I shouldn't.
Yeah.
Totally. So I want, you know, maybe that's a place to sort of round out this conversation.
Yeah.
Somebody recognizes that they need to or want to go through this work. Maybe they do not have the privilege of being in a situation where they can afford therapy, traditional therapy. What are some recommendations that you have for people just starting on this journey? You know, are there ways that they can afford to speak to a trauma therapist that maybe we don't know about? People inside of the field tend to know how to get services a little better.
Yeah. And just the last thought with that last piece too, this has been coming up a lot, but you know, there's always that default. I don't say always, there's that default within the community. I've totally been guilty of it, to be like, but go back to our roots. Like back in the day, people didn't have to go through all of these, you know, X, Y, and Z interventions. But back in the
day, we also died at 30. I love when people are like, appeal to age. Back in the day,
way before this,
ancient wisdom.
All the time, yes. And that was the thing. So like 100%. And also, yes, there were definitely a tremendous amount of pieces in place culturally too, you know, that were able to support an individual going through trauma work in a way that they gained meaning from it, or an initiatory experience. You know, Carl Jung himself, a lot of his work, the foundation of it was what he learned from shamanic cultures. So that exists. That's also not what a lot of us have and are living in right now, you know, unfortunately. And also exactly what you said, you know, people weren't doing well a while ago. You know, we could probably scrap psychology and be fine, sure, but like not at the same time. You know, a lot of us would do really poorly and a lot of people would die. And so it's important to walk it carefully. So anyway, that was my last. People weren't doing well a long time ago is my last thought on that.
But I you do bring up a very important point. There are cultures that you know, and this goes back to sociology. Of course, I think everything goes back to sociology. A psychologist thinks everything goes back to psychology. A botanist thinks everything goes back to botany. But you know, this goes back to sociology, where, you know, we're talking about cultures and societies and peoples, and there are some societies that support and enable and create space for people to talk about their feelings and to process trauma and to process depression and anxiety and to work through it. And if they can't work through it, then to have a support network, either professional network or whatever, you know. And this isn't a new thing. There are cultures for hundreds, thousands of years that have supportive systems in place to make sure that your mental and spiritual well-being are cared for. Yeah. However, it is 2021. Mm-hmm. We are all living through a pancetta. I think if anything, we've realized that maybe we're not all as great, as doing great as we like to tell ourselves that we are. And unfortunately, in a lot of places around the world, the United States especially, we don't really have that culture. One, we don't really support talking about our feelings. Right. We don't, you know, there's a lot of gender roles there. There's a lot of patriarchy there. There's a lot of all sorts of stuff, but we don't have that. And we also don't have the professional access, you know, even with insurance.
Yeah. It's
getting counseling. I mean, you know, I can go to, I think my insurance lets me go to 3 sessions a year before I start paying, and it's paying out of pocket, like full dollar. Yeah. And it's expensive. Yeah. So I go to how much I can, but, you know, I would like to go to therapy a lot more than I can.
Yeah, me too. I'm real about it.
So I apologize. Yeah. Back to somebody is going on this journey. What are ways that they can access either professional services, and are there ways that somebody can at least safely begin to go on this journey on their own?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the initial thing is, and I always bring it back to this, is also listen to your, for each, everybody listening, and just listen to your gut, listen to your feeling about what you need. Just, and start with that. You know, honestly, if your gut is like, I feel like I want to get that book on Amazon and I want to start doing this work, start it. You know, listening to what you intuitively and genuinely feel is right for you is invaluable. It is the most important thing. That's the biggest thing. You know, a lot of this work too, whether you're doing it individually with any kind of practitioner, is also, you know, it's walking through those depths and the unknowns, doing it with support carefully and thoughtfully, and also gaining meaning from it and learning from it. So that's kind of the other side that is so, I don't want to not talk about, because finding meaning is key. But starting with your intuitive self, as far as the ins and outs of therapy, there are some like tips and tricks, which is such a, has to be a thing, but there are some things.
So life like, hacks, therapy hacks, hashtag therapy hacks. I hate a hack. I'm sorry. I hate hacks.
I know, right? It's so, but it's sick. It's, I mean, I get enraged when I look at the landscape of psychology right now. Knowing, you know, we put it out there and say how important it is, and then it's so grossly inaccessible, and that's not okay. So I'm a part of my, like,
the number of times that I see on social media, oh, just go to therapy about that. And I'm like, oh, baby, I would if I could.
It is. So
you need to be in therapy. Yeah. Yes, we all do. I agree.
So until, I mean, I also do like advocating and a lot of work on the other end, on the bigger end of it. And that has to keep being done. That's also, that's a thing for another time, but seeking out a therapist, if you are sensing that that is something that you need a higher level of support, seeking out a therapist who is, trauma informed, there's certain code words. Like if you look online and you're looking for, you know, Jungian analysis or dream work. I do dream work too. A lot of those things, you're going to get somebody who you have to pay out of pocket for. And it's ridiculously expensive. I know, I've been on both sides of it. To get a sense of somebody who is looking up trauma work, also looking into anybody who does anything along the lines of like Jungian, art therapy. A lot of times you could find somebody who is willing to traverse and train to traverse those inner caverns versus something like cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, which is much more about kind of patching you up and sending you on your way. My God, I know that was such a good hate mail for this.
I'm used to it. It's okay.
But it's different. It's a different thing. Cognitive behavioral therapy and therapies that are much more geared towards that short-term band-aid are a different thing. That's not trauma therapy. If you can find somebody who does EMDR, art therapy or a Jungian therapist, that's kind of where you would want to look if you're looking to go into these deeper depths. So knowing that those two are two different options. If you sense, and especially if you're going through some things that you know are risky, that you know yourself, you know, if you know that you can tend to get into a really dark place that you can't get out of, or have any kind of history of, you know, self-harm or anything that put you anywhere near that edge of life or death, it's important to have a therapist there in place. If that's there, you know that's what you need, but then insurance is a barrier. There's a thing called a single case exemption. I can actually send this stuff to you and fill it out. Most of us have some degree of coverage to some extent, even if it's terrible. But if you found somebody that's a good fit and you know that that's what you need, you can contact your insurance provider and ask for a single case exemption. And basically what you're telling them is, this is what I need. This is a matter of urgency or life or death. And I need to see somebody of this type of therapy. And if your insurance cannot provide you someone who is an appropriate match within a short distance, I think it's something like 5 miles or 10 miles, they have to cover you. They're supposed to cover you. Mm. So that's kind of like a little weird loophole that actually I've seen.
That sounds like a really good trick to sort of know, especially if you're in a more rural area.
Yeah.
You know, and they say, oh, you know, go see this therapist in Cityville. Well, no, Cityville is 30 miles away and this person is 2 miles away. I'm going to go to my person.
Yes. Yeah. And you just explain to them, you know, this is, I need this. And I've seen it work. It doesn't always, not across the board, you know, but that's one of those things that they like kind of don't want you to know because they do pay out. And they will cover. The other option too is, you know, finding somebody, anybody. Sometimes, you know, we can find support. And I mean, some of the most amazing therapists I've also known work in community mental health centers. That 100% is a viable option if that's also there and accessible to you. You know, a beautiful way to walk this is also doing your own inner work, whether that's your journal or kind of however else you feel called to go in. Having supports around you, which is obviously a challenge in and of itself right now, but having somebody to call, anybody, any support, and then also having a professional that you know is there as an ally. Even if you meet with that person once a month and your insurance only covers that, or even if you just, you know, if you're all out of pocket and you're not going to go more than once, just having a number, having somebody to call is important. You know, there's more to that as far as resources, and I could actually send you.
Yeah, great. And we can put them up on the website.
Yeah. But I mean, I encourage you just to trust your gut with it and know where you're going to go. And most importantly, not get pressured to do something that doesn't feel right for you. You know, I've seen the most damage caused, honestly, and of course therapy, this happens too, but in circles or in spiritual spaces where everybody's doing it and it's like, oh, we've got to open this up now. And it might not feel right, but you're told it is right. And, you know, that is kind of where that gets a little dangerous. So just keep listening to yourself. You know.
Are there any red flags for you? Anything? I really like what you said earlier about, you know, if I'm doing my own self-guided work, in a journal, in something like that, you know, you write out a contract with yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, I will go here and no further. You know, if I reach this point, then I know I need to go seek elevated care. But are there any red flags if you are existing either in that self-guided space or if you're existing in that outside of, you know, accredited, accountable space and you're going to one of the, you know, natural versus organic, if you're going to the natural versus the organic, you're going to that and suddenly someone starts bringing up these kinds of issues. Are there red flag statements that they make, ways that people approach this kind of information that might be red flags for you to where somebody knows, you know what, I need to stop and I need to get out of this situation?
Totally. Absolutely. And I've been there. And it's funny because like, you can listen to your intuition all day, but then something seems interesting and you're sitting in front of somebody and Yeah, they dropped something. Yeah, for sure. I mean, one, this is not going to be a popular thing, but this is my my own sense about it is not across the board. A lot of times, if somebody identifies themselves as the one doing the healing, that gives me pause. I don't want to say it's always a big red flag, like you have to stop, but that gives me pause. That begs the question of what are the boundaries? Who is this serving? What's their stuff or ego or whatever happening, you know? And then what do they, as the practitioner, expect to get out of it? Mm. When somebody comes and says, like, I'm going to heal you, I'm the healer, I'm going to heal you, there's a whole other layer of pressure there that can be very damaging, mm-hmm. especially for somebody who really needs a safe place to open up. You know, yeah, this work can happen quickly, totally. And also this work can be unfolding for a decade. You know, everybody opens it up in their own ways. So that the healer thing and that kind of always gives me pause. Yeah. The other piece is what kind of promises or how are they advertising this? Mm. Are they advertising it as the process or are they advertising it as the destination? You know, it's fortunately you don't see too many therapists that say, I'm going to heal you. You're going to feel better. This is going to be great. because we know that, you know, that's not always the goal. The goal is movement. The goal is process. The goal is all of that. And there should always be movement, but it's not always pretty and shiny. So if somebody has up on their site, you know, they're promising you these things that those are big red flags for me because that's not how healing usually works. It's messy. It's ugly. It takes time sometimes. And it's not something that you can fit into like a 20-minute session by Zoom. I mean, let's be real. Like, it's nice. It helps for sure. But that would also give me pause.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for being here. This is a big, big, big conversation. I'm sure this is not the last time that we'll talk. I hope not. I'm sure that there are a lot of folks that are going to have even more questions that I didn't think of that are even better than the questions that I asked about shadow work, about trauma counseling, the intersection of mental health and spirituality and spiritual counseling. But I hope that this gives people a springboard. And like we said, there will be additional resources on the website for folks that want a little bit more information about that. But for folks that want a little bit more information about you, where can they find you?
Thank you. In the last couple of years, I've been more kind of in the realm of my writing. Mm-hmm. I have my website if you want to learn a little bit more about Enodia. It's enodiacenter.com. As you can see when you're there, the practice and the work itself is a bit underground. But I have my website at laurentheresa.com where I have a little bit more about me and my work, my poetry, my writing, which actually dives quite a bit into shadow work. I have a book that I've actually just finished not too long ago it's kind of an immersive fiction poetry collection of a dive through the shadows and meeting with the unconscious. And it is spiritual and psychological and messy and pretty and all of that good witchy stuff. So it's all there.
I love that. Well, thank you so much, Lauren, for being here. I think people are going to get a lot out of this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. To be continued.
Well, rioters, that's going to do it here for us today on this episode of Inciting a Riot, Inciting a Shadow Work Riot. My immense thanks go out to Lauren Theresa, my guest today. More information about how to find her and contact her and engage with her work will be on the website at incitingariot.com. If you'd like to email me about this show or any other, you can do so at firelight, that's F-I-R-E-L-Y-T-E, at incitingariot.com. I would be remiss if I didn't mention real quick and upfront here that later this month, and I cannot believe that I get to say that, later this month, my first book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, will be hitting bookshelves around the country and around the world, and will be available both in person, online, as an ebook, as an audiobook, as a paperback. And I've seen the paperback, and it's freaking beautiful. If you'd like to pre-order the book, please, please, please do. You can do so at bit.ly/dabblersguide, or go to your online bookstore of choice, or your independent bookstore of choice, or your witchy bookstore of choice, and tell them that you would like to order The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. Please, 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 please do not let money be a hindrance to your ability to read this book. If you want to read this book, there are a number of ways that you can do so that are accessible, but the biggest one that I'm a proponent of is engage with your local library. Request the book at your local library. If they don't have it and don't want to order it for their inventory, they can borrow it from another library that has it. But requesting the book at your local library is a really good way to get the book out there, get it into circulation, and get it into other people's hands. And it's a free service to you. Support your local library. You're already paying for it. We're all already paying for it. So go ahead and engage with it. If you'd like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider liking and sharing it on social media. You can also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to this. If your pod catcher of choice has the ability to leave a review, please do that. Even a word, even an emoji, helps to bump the show up in the algorithm and gets it into the ears of people like you that might want to think deeply about interesting subjects. Help keep the show free and producing on a regular basis by chipping in a little bit of money if that's something that you're able to do. If you'd like to do it one time, you can buy me a coffee, or you can join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and monthly chats with special guests. And this month, everybody at the roundtable tier of the Patreon will be getting a signed paperback of The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. Yes, so that will be the discussion for this month. We're going to be doing a little bit of a book club with my book. So if you'd like to be a part of that, sign up for the roundtable tier. I would do it pretty quickly if you want to be part of the roundtable so that I can make sure that you have a book and you have enough time to read it. One last thing. It is September, which means that next month is October, which means that I am already planning my Samhain special. If you'll recall, last year and in all of the years past, for the history of the show, I have done a Samhain story share. Most years, what that looks like is that independent musicians from around the world submit music that's played, and also lots of you all in the audience submit stories, poems, spells, interesting bits of folklore that you like, and typically you all read them. I have had nonfiction personal accounts of ghost encounters. I have had fairy tales. I have had witchy children's stories. I have had very creepy folklore. And every year I write an original short story that I also read on the show. This year, because I do have a growing number of patrons and they are very wonderful and are helping me to do cool things, I have decided to make this a little bit of a contest and also to entice you to send in your work if that's something you're thinking of doing. If you have a short story, if you have a poem, if you have a spell, if you just have a favorite bit of folklore, run to your closet, whip your phone out, record yourself reading it, and send it in to firelight@incitingariot.com. You can say 2021 Samhain show in the subject line, or just, you know, my short story or something like that. And I will know to consider it for the show. I'm going to make this a contest. There will be 3 prizes. The grand prize wins $50. You win $50 plus a copy of my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. Second prize wins $25 and a copy of The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. And third prize wins The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. You all will still be considered to be on the show, even if you don't win a prize. But it's pretty cool to win a prize. So get those in. Winners, the deadline for submission is September 30th at midnight. And then I'll be reading them over the first week of October and things will be announced. I think it's Friday, October 8th is that first Friday. And then I'll be producing the show and putting it out later that month. Anyways, that's going to be it from me. Thank you all so much for supporting and downloading the show. Please go out there, rate, like, subscribe. I do have a YouTube channel now as well. I keep forgetting to say that. So if you want to find me on there, links are going to be in the show notes at incitingariot.com. And of course, you can find me on all forms of social media at Inciting a Riot. But I'm going to leave you. But as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.